Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. As I imagine we all know, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been the longest wars in American history, lasting for nearly 20 and 18 years, respectively. I guess the war in Iraq officially ended in 2011, making it 9 years, but we still have troops there. Thousands of American lives have been lost, and tens of thousands more badly wounded inside and out, and between the two, the cost has been about $5 trillion. It's impossible to estimate the civilian loss of life in those two countries, but it's probably over 250,000. So you can judge for yourself what we've gotten for that huge expenditure of blood, treasure, and national morale, and if it's been worth it. The anti-theme of American Variety, if you know this, is anything but politics. But wars are beyond politics. They get into deeper questions of right and wrong and where we stand in history. And today we're going to look at one small aspect of the fallout from the Iraq War. Small in the larger context of the war, but huge to those involved in it. We're going to talk with a U.S. Army officer who's been leading a desperate fight to get Iraqis who worked with us as interpreters and in other roles out of there and into the U.S. before we pull out entirely and they and their families are all slaughtered by ISIS. My guest is retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Steve Miska. He runs something called the Project to Strategically Protect Soft Networks and has recently written a book called The Baghdad Underground Railroad, Saving American Allies in Iraq. Welcome, Colonel Miska.
Thanks, Court. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you on. He's joining us from California. Can we call you Steve?
Yes, sir. I didn't really care much about rank when I was in the service, so I absolutely don't now.
Okay, good man. First, why don't you tell us, though, a little about your military background, particularly in the Middle East?
Sure. I graduated from West Point and then did a typical sort of what I would call infantry career. After getting stationed in Germany in the early 2000s, I got caught up in what I would call the Iraq do loop of deployments, where I deployed three times over the span of 40 months to Iraq, or for a total of 40 months in a country. 2004 in Tikrit, Saddam's hometown. 2006 and 7 for 16 months in Baghdad, and in 2009 down in the Shia provinces of Diwaniya, Najaf, and Babel.
Yeah, so you were kind of deep into it, and you worked a lot with the interpreters and Iraqi kind of partners of the military effort there. And, I started off talking about the risk they're facing now as we kind of wind down sharply in Iraq, and you're one of the people leading an effort to try to save their lives. How many people of that type are at risk in Iraq?
So Iraq currently has over 100,000 people who were affiliated with us. The numbers are difficult to gather, as I'm sure you could imagine. It's complex because we go to war with defense contractors, who are the people that actually do the hiring of our local nationals. It's difficult to get the data in order to really analyze it. But from the nonprofit community that's focused in this space, the humanitarian groups, they're saying it's over 100,000 Iraqis who are at risk right now.
And these are not only interpreters, but also other kinds of supporters, like who?
They're people who may have worked on logistics projects. They might have been even engineers out in the field with some of our folks. So they tend to be skilled beyond just a command of English, and they were invaluable for us in order to perform our mission. They are basically our cultural eyes, ears, and mouthpieces.
So are they being actively hunted now in Iraq?
Yes, you do have some ISIS sleeper cells, and I heard you mention ISIS at the beginning, but the main threat for American-affiliated Iraqis are Iranian-backed militias. And they are, especially since the Soleimani strike back last year in January, that has really created much stronger tension than previously between Iranians and anybody with an American affiliation.
So among the general Iraqi population of people who live there, as opposed to Iranian militias, are these American-affiliated Iraqis thought negatively of? Are they despised, or is it kind of neutral, or how are they viewed, just in a nutshell?
It depends on where you are, and it depends on your support networks. But in general, especially in the interpreter populations, they go to great pains not to disclose an American affiliation to anybody that they don't know. And even sure. many times to their own family members. They won't disclose it for fear that inadvertently somebody will give it away to the wrong person.
Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous business. So, well, I'm going to ask you, Steve, this is going to be one of those shows I already know that I wish would be longer than half an hour, but that's all we've got for it. So, but just give me very briefly, if you can, one story, let's say, of the kind of thing that happens to an interpreter who gets outed, so to speak, and discovered by the militia.
Sure. So one of my interpreters, Jack, was his combat nickname, and all of the interpreters use nicknames because if you knew their real name, you would know where they came from in Iraq, and you could actually probably track down their family. So they had to go with Noam Degares, and Jack received, he had gone home to Balad from Baghdad in 2007 and was held at gunpoint by insurgents, and his father came out and mediated, and they were able to come to a compromise where if Jack swore on the Quran that he was not working with Americans in the green zone, then they would believe him and let him go. So Jack made it safely back to us, and about 2 months after that, his wife gave birth to stillborn twins, and he was distraught and decided to go home. When he got there, that same group interceded and basically said, you've been lying to us. And which technically, I think from Jack's perspective, it wasn't a lie because he wasn't working with Americans in the green zone. The green zone would have been much safer. He was out with us on patrol every day. And so they assassinated him that night. And his father called us from Jack's cell phone to let us know that he was no longer with us.
Yeah, so I imagine that story is playing out a lot over a period of years and will play out more in the future, and that's what you're trying to protect against and prevent. So tell us about the relationship between the interpreters and their American counterparts, whether they're contractors or servicemen. I mean, does it get personal? Are they friends, or is it just strictly a tough working relationship or what?
Yeah, in some cases, there's friendship, I would say, but it's a bond. It's a bond, depending on the role, right? If it's an interpreter who is out on patrol with people like me every day, that bond is forged in shared risk. And in the interpreters, in many cases, they're taking on more risk because many times their families are at risk as well. So, and they take great pains to insulate their families, but there's only so much you can do when people are actively hunting you. And so anyway, those relationships over time come into our ethos of, in the military, leave no one behind. When you go out on patrol, we bring everybody back. And when we deploy back from Iraq to whatever home base we came from, all of a sudden, we feel like we're violating that ethos. We feel like we're leaving this really critical partner behind. We know he's still at risk. And it creates this real tension for the veteran community in particular.
Yeah, I mentioned in the beginning your project to strategically protect soft networks. And I'm guessing we can kind of infer what a soft network is, but go ahead and describe that if you would.
Sure. Yeah. Soft networks are any local national partners who collaborate alongside of us. And I mean us in a broader than a military sense, right? In conflict zones. So they can be interpreters, but they're logisticians, people that are enabling the projects to happen. A store owner of mine was gunned down by Shia militia a couple weeks after Jack was killed. So it's risky business. Many times, it doesn't matter what your contribution is. It's just you're affiliated with the occupiers and you're considered a traitor. And so from that perspective, soft networks are those people who enable us to accomplish a mission in conflict zones. And the reason that I use the term soft is because from the enemy's perspective, they're a soft target. They're easier than, Steve Meska in an upper Humvee or a diplomat in a hardened embassy somewhere.
Sure. Yeah, I'm wondering, had promises been made to these folks, I guess mainly men, but some women, about their fate when U.S. forces would inevitably leave? I mean, was there any planning ahead of time for that, or was it just kind of left open-ended?
So the special immigrant visa Congress enacted in 2006 and then started expanding it in 2007. And that's sort of where the story of the Underground Railroad comes from. But it's different between Afghanistan and Iraq, but those are the two places where we've had the SIV, the special immigrant visa. The Iraq program is no longer valid because when we withdrew in 2011, Congress set a twilight clause on there for 3 years. So if you had not submitted an application by 2014, you are not eligible. So it's basically a real mess from an immigration refugee perspective in Iraq. The Afghan SIV is still active, and actually Congress is taking measures to expand it.
So there is a difference between the two countries. It's pretty drastic, I guess. And you're working mainly on the Iraq side of that then?
No, I've been very active on Afghanistan over the last couple months, only because I understand the risks to soft networks and the threats, and I can inform the immigration lawyers and the humanitarian advocates on how to best posture their messaging, because I worked on the Obama administration as well and have a lot of contacts on the current administration, I help in that space too.
So I gather that this issue is more urgent and pressing in Afghanistan than it is in Iraq, right?
Absolutely. Because of the security situation, the withdrawal, observers are basically commenting that they believe the withdrawal is precipitating a crisis for the Afghan National Security Forces in particular. We are seeing indications of that, whether or not it will go the route of the fall of Saigon or whether or not it will look like the Russian withdrawal in 1989. Those are sort of the two case studies that I would bookend the security situation around.
Yeah. So is the state of the government in the two countries a big factor in that as well?
Yeah, I mean, the government definitely plays a role. The reason why our interpreters in particular and other members of our soft networks are at risk is because neither of those governments have indicated a desire or even a capability to protect people who had collaborated with Americans. And so it becomes a national security challenge for us, also for other Western countries that had the same level of support, although on a much smaller scale.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in political support here for Iraqis versus Afghans for any reason in Congress, for example?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think if you talk to members of Congress who are veterans, they will say no. But there seems to be a groundswell of political support, and it's bipartisan. So you tell me how many bipartisan issues we have nowadays on the Hill. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are stepping up for the Afghans in particular right now. We're not seeing those sorts of indications on the Iraq side of the equation.
Hmm. But you've, I think, in the course of your years of dealing with this issue, have dealt more with the Iraqi side of the equation. So do you see that that's coming along next as being a similar thing, next in line, and going to be the same pressures and the same decisions?
I think so, yeah. What I'm doing is working alongside some of the nonprofits in this space who are forward-leaning on those types of ideas. And there's been discussions over the last few years in Congress of enacting legislation that anytime we go into a conflict zone, we would have some sort of tool like the special immigrant visa that would give us a safety valve to protect those who are most close to us in those dangerous areas.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and I'm talking with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Miska, an Army colonel, who's written a book called The Baghdad Underground Railroad, Saving American Allies in Iraq. And we're, of course, talking about the effort to rescue people in both Afghanistan and Iraq who've worked with U.S. military and coalition forces, I guess, in those countries during those very long-running wars in support roles of different kinds, who, when we leave, will be immediately targeted for death along with their families. And so it's kind of a desperate effort, particularly right now in the case of Afghanistan, to get those people out. How many people are we talking about I mean, we talked about that at the beginning, but as far as the Afghans who may be rescued fairly soon, do you have any way of knowing whether it'll be all of them or some subset, or is that just total speculation at this point?
Well, I do know the population is over 18,000 interpreters. And when you factor in their family members, you're talking about 70,000 people total. Whether or not the plans that are underway are including that entire population remains to be seen. But I think the indications that we're seeing are a desire to start doing something for those most at risk.
Hmm. The title of your book is The Baghdad Underground Railroad. So what is or was the Underground Railroad, and is it still operating?
So the Underground Railroad began in 2007 in Baghdad. It was the height of sectarian cleansing in Iraq, the height of the Iraq conflict, as surge forces began coming in. And what was happening was our interpreters were being killed out from underneath us by many different actors. And the risks were extreme. And they really didn't have any good options except for this new special immigrant visa that had been passed, that somebody who had served for at least 12 months with U.S. forces and who had passed all the security screening could then apply for this visa. And so we began, what we realized, though, was the bureaucracy was so arcane that no Iraqi was going to be able to figure it out. We couldn't figure it out. And so we started trying to do just that for our Iraqi colleagues. And the reason we used the Underground Railroad was because I know this is going to be, you know, blow your listeners' minds, but there was actually a catch-22 in the system. The Baghdad embassy had closed to interviews because they cited it was too dangerous to interview Iraqis. And so they had to go to Amman, Jordan. Well, the Jordanians had closed the border to Iraqis because they had a refugee crisis on their hands. So the catch-22. And just to put it in context, how dangerous it was, Court, every month in Iraq at that time, leading up to when we started the Baghdad Underground Railroad, there were 3,000 casualties or more. And so that's a 9/11 every month in Iraq. And the epicenter of it was Baghdad. That's where the vast majority of those casualties were occurring. So it was just really lethal to work alongside Americans at that time.
You're saying 3,000 per month of these people who were working alongside Americans, not just broadly of all combatants, but those people?
No. 3,000 per month of both Iraqi civilians, security forces, and any, you know, people in the country, which by scholarly definition, anything over 1,000 casualties indicates a civil war. So this was a real, just very bloody time frame.
I mentioned in the beginning, Steve, that you had been at this for some years. So how long have you actually been at it and trying to do this, and how much success have you had so far?
Well, so the Underground Railroad, we were able to get dozens out at that time in 2007. And to really paint a picture for your listeners about how vital these men and, as you pointed out, some women were, six of the about three dozen that I got out enlisted in either the U.S. Army or Marines when they got to the United States. And then they deployed back as combat linguists. And they've continued, in some cases, in our national security fields to contribute in ways that no native-born American could do. So they're just really vital. So there was some success back then, despite a lot of casualties. And we continue to make progress. What has happened, what I would call success, are the nonprofits like the International Refugee Assistance Project, No One Left Behind, Miri's List. These are nonprofits that have sprung up in the decade since I really came back with this burning issue to Washington. And they're complementing the gaps in our national security space. They're complementing the government resettlement agencies where they might not have the typical resources to help somebody coming from, say, Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria to really assimilate well when they get here to the U.S.
Where do they tend to stay when they get here? How do they resettle and where, just quickly? I imagine several places, but anyway, just kind of roughly.
Yeah, they're all across the country. There are concentrations. So say if you're looking at San Diego, the El Cajon neighborhood tends to receive Afghans and Iraqis who are at risk. Up in L.A., there are different areas. Houston has a large population. In Detroit, the Washington, D.C. area. So many times, and it depends on how they arrive, if it's a special immigrant visa versus some sort of refugee status, and they're allocated to one of the nine different resettlement agencies, those agencies have different centers of gravity, I guess, if you will, throughout the country. And so that'll make it more likely where they will end up.
I would imagine they gravitate, if they have any say in it, which they may not, toward places where there are other people who speak their language and who have their background and are like themselves, right?
Yeah, where their support networks are. I mean, right. For the most part, these are people who do speak English, so they do have a leg up on the typical immigrant who's arriving because they're, that was why we hired them in many cases.
Right, sure. You know, I think you were probably one of the early people pushing this, and I think worked in the White House Security Council in this role for a while, but you mentioned that other people and some NGOs and so on have expanded into this area. And so how many, like, other officers and other kind of entities are now working on this effort the same way you are?
Well, I don't know about the same way I am. I think there are probably thousands who are advocating. There's a group called Veterans for American Ideals, and they've got a network of thousands of veterans across the country who are very passionate about this issue. And as I mentioned too, our young men and women, when they come back from their time in service with this particular issue, they are feeling like they're violating that ethos that we inculcated in them. And we don't want them going home to talk to their, prospective recruits if they feel that way about their country. And so that's why the long-term game for me is very much the policy development space, where when we go into conflict zones, we proactively insulate our soft networks. We go in with our eyes open, knowing that our adversaries will target them. And we do things both in the cyber realm as well as in the physical space to better protect them.
Hey, you mentioned earlier, we've talked about some of the issues that have been obstacles to this, but over the long course of what you've been doing, what have been some of the really major roadblocks you've encountered? Just kind of briefly, we're getting toward the end of the show a little bit.
Yeah. So, one of them is just I mentioned a bureaucracy when we were talking about the Baghdad Underground Railroad. That has not gotten better, unfortunately. There was a time, and just to clarify, I did not work on this particular issue on the Obama administration. I was director for Iraq for security. And part of that was because I felt the people who were working on it were absolutely competent and doing a good job. But also, I did not feel comfortable because I was so personally involved in it that I would have attempted to recuse myself had somebody asked me to work on the policy. But during the Obama years, they did make efficiencies, and they got up to the point where they were processing about 4,000 visas per year. And that's why Afghanistan in particular is at such a crisis mode, is because when you've got a population of 18,000, you're just not going to get through that in time, given the pending withdrawal. So that the SIV bureaucracy is still very challenging space, and Congress is attempting to take measures, I think, to streamline it and help us out a bit.
Yeah, plus I think there are kind of workarounds of basically in the works even of trying to get people out of the country in large numbers, maybe to third countries where they can be kind of parked for a while and just wait out that backlog and see what happens. But
yeah, absolutely. And as a security professional, I mean, I know the immigration lawyers and the, humanitarian advocates are not going to like the idea of a third country. But as somebody who is really, my expertise is in the security space, I want to see them out of harm's way. And, sure. You know, if it's in U.S. territory, that's fine. But if it's not, it's exactly as you said. It gives us the time and space to do a thorough job of vetting so we don't make mistakes.
Yeah, overall, then, Steve, how does this issue affect our national security? I mean, it's not immediately obvious why saving a few thousand interpreters in a country affects our own national security, but there is a direct connection to that, if you could explain that kind of briefly.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's. I'll give you three quick points. The first one is we've got men and women in harm's way right now around the world, and they are relying on interpreters. And so they are watching how we treat those who are affiliated with Americans in Afghanistan. So if we don't do the right thing in Afghanistan, then we risk undermining those relationships real time right now. The second point I would say is anytime a bomb goes off anywhere in the world, we will have agents investigate that to determine whether or not there are trends that we need to worry about to protect the homeland. What informant is going to trust an American who's asking for sensitive intelligence if they see we just abandon our closest partners in Afghanistan? And then the third point I would just say is our young men and women who are going home, you know, if they feel ashamed of their country after taking off their uniform and during their time in service, that's not how we want them to interact with the next generation of military service members coming up.
Yeah. Well, you're doing humanitarian work. You're a soldier with a heart, and there are quite a few of them, I am sure. It's sometimes hard work to do in a war zone and in a system that's bulky and not set up to operate that way. But, I mean, you said at the beginning you're a West Point graduate and a veteran of three tours in a war zone, and so now you're retired. Colonel, do you have any idealism left?
Yes. I don't think I could carry on, Court, if I didn't. And, you know, it comes from the other soldiers with heart and other advocates with heart who are focused on these issues. It, working alongside of them is just really, we buttress each other up. It comes from the interpreters that I helped get out, and I'm still in touch with them and hearing about their contributions. And, that's where I think we really make a difference is we know we saved lives, and that helps counter some of those really negative times that we experience in those deployments.
Well, you're doing all you can do, and you're doing great stuff. To the extent you succeed, each life counts, right? So we've been talking with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Miska. And Steve, I want to thank you so much for being on with us at American Variety.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure, Court. Thanks for having me.
And again, the book you want to get and read, it just came out recently in May, is The Baghdad Underground Railroad, Saving American Allies in Iraq. And Steve's last name is spelled M-I-S-K-A. It's available at Amazon and all the usual booksellers. It's very well written. You can look up Steve Miska on LinkedIn, for example. He's involved in a number of other things that we don't have time to go into here, but they're kind of all kind of constellation, related to this kind of thing we're talking about. So thanks again, Steve, and I want to thank all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.